Okay, so I wanted to ask you guys about when size matters, because the big idea, okay, back up. So Zach's prayer that you guys would get something helpful out of the lesson today was an especially apt one, because I feel like, we'll see what it turns out in the next half hour, but I feel like today's lesson is like, you know when you go to those parties and they have that fancy, it's not a centerpiece, but the dish, like the center is the big cheese egg. I don't know what it actually is, but you know what I'm talking about? The big thing of cheese that you put, you take your cracker and you get the cheese out. I don't know what those are called. Cheese ball? Okay, it looks like an egg to me, but all right. Welcome to precision. Anyway, but like around it is all this other stuff. It's like a wreath of other snack food, if you will. But I say all that because the cheese ball is the objective today, but I feel like there's a bunch of other stuff scattered here. I mean, usually my lessons are 2 pages long, and this one's 4 pages with all kinds of arrows and notes scattered all over it. So I say all that because the big idea is what I'll share in a moment, but I'm hoping there's all kinds of other stuff in here that maybe you can grab something, because after all, the goal is not to be good. The goal is to be helpful. So we'll see. Now that I've set myself up for failure, we'll see if this launches. But I asked about, you know, when does size matter? Because the big idea for today is to exercise contentment instead of complaint, because we sort of realize how big our God is. And I think I'm going to try to make the case that so often our problems are because we don't realize how incredibly big our God is. And when you realize how big your God is, it really helps. The quote, I'm stealing the quote from J.B. Phillips. J.B. Phillips, as in the guy who wrote the Phillips, what's his paraphrase called? Not the message. Anyway, J.B. Phillips, but really cool guy. If you ever get bored, look him up. He was a minister during World War II. I think he was killed in the Blitz, but don't quote me on that. I could be wrong. But anyway, he had made the Phillips translation of the New Testament, and he died before he could finish the Old Testament. But I say all that to say, one of his things that he was really famous for saying was, every Christian's problem is his God is too small. So now that I've given that way too long intro, let me get into how we're going to make that point. So last week, which I was not here for, but Joe talked about how, and especially shame on me for missing a Fellowship of the Ring reference, right? But how God is with us as we go out. And so as God is with us, we should be obedient and trust him. And so the Israelites at this point will have just left Sinai. Like all of the very tail end of Exodus and all of Leviticus and the first section of Numbers all covers about a 2-month period where the Israelites are at Sinai getting the law and getting all the instructions and stuff like that. Sorry, I have this thing. When I teach Old Testament at school and with Brent, I have this, it's 50 hand motions to summarize the Old Testament. So like I have this urge as I'm telling you, they're doing law, tabernacle, offerings and feasts, counting and spying. Anyway, like, just so that was the odd hesitation. And if you ever want to learn it, it is a pretty cool way to summarize the Old Testament, both for yourself and for your, kids. But anyway, so, you know, because it always throws people off because they can't remember how many animals David took on the ark and, you know, how Moses defeated Goliath and stuff like that. So you got to get your Old Testament stories in order and get them right. All right, anyway, so the Israelites have been getting all that stuff from Mount Sinai, and now they're finally setting out. And unfortunately, like, things are going to go bad from the word go. And so I'll tell you what, let's just go ahead and launch into the text. We're going to see that in Numbers 11, verses 1 through 3. We're going to start with this relatively unspecified but still not very good event. And I've broken the lesson down into 3 sections: wrong treasure, wrong desire, and wrong responsibility. And actually, tell you what, let me just stop at that, because let's get into the text proper and I'll unpack where I'm going in a moment. So if somebody'd be so gracious as to read verses 1 through 3, please.
God's anger blazed against them, then come fire to them. Then the people spoke to Moses. when he prayed to the Lord, fire stopped. After that, the area was known as Kibroth. Fire.
Thank you kindly. Okay, I know I didn't give you any kind of guiding question, but any reactions to that story? We've just set out, like if you looked at verse or at chapter 10, they had just like basically gotten their marching orders and started out from Sinai, and this is the next story. So anyway, any reactions, surprises, anything like that? Again, it's a very vague question, I acknowledge, so... Hear, hear. Kind of probably makes some of us think of driving our kids somewhere, right? How far away from the driveway with your undercarriage scraping do you get before the kids, you know, have questions or complain or he touched me or something like that? Touche. Touche. Didn't make it out of the driveway. Okay. Any other observations or questions? Touche. Well, then. Hear, hear. And the naming will come up again as we go through several more stories. Any other reactions or questions?
They're not going to stop.
And we will see that. That's true.
This fire burns. This is like when you're like quick to wind in.
Apparently. I know this isn't quite what Hallie was saying, but for my part, and you know, again, maybe this is just me, but for my part, it's like, I mean, I don't really, hear me, it would be blasphemous to really say this. I don't really mean this, but goodness gracious, Lord, take a chill pill. Like, isn't that a little much? You know what I mean? Like, they're in a desert. Cut them some slack there. But that's not, you know, obviously, right? I mean, he's God Almighty. He knows exactly what he's doing. That's not the way the Lord deals with it. So my initial response was, goodness, all they were doing was complaining. Like, why such a strong response? And it is a strong response, obviously, but their complaint was pretty bad. So I was thinking about this, and I'm going to, as usual, take a fairly circuitous route to, I hope, make a fairly decent point. As I'm thinking about, something's going to go wrong in each of these three sections. And in this first one, the thing that goes wrong is that the Israelites complain. And it's interesting because we're not even told exactly about what they complain. They complain about the adversity, but we're not told specifically what happened. And even the punishment is a bit vague because, you know, fire strikes the outskirts of the camp and some of them get destroyed and stuff like that. So it's definitely, it's almost like a prologue. It's setting up something that somebody pointed out. The complaining is going to continue. But on the one hand, like, it should make us very, very slow to complain. And so it got me to thinking, okay, so what's the big deal with complaining? Like, why is it such a bad thing? I mean, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know what it was like with you guys, but at least in my world growing up, like, complaint was very normal. I would imagine, I don't know this to be the case because I work in a Christian place, but I imagine complaint is a fairly common occurrence in the workplace, you know, at the water cooler and stuff like that. So what's, I mean, it's just, life's hard, so you gripe about it. That's normal, right? Like, but apparently not, according to the Lord. So here's some thoughts I got. First off, this made me think of, and I'm going to take you to some theology school just for a moment and come back, but it made me think of sort of the classic teaching on what evil is, like Augustine and Dante and even Tolkien. Evil is good that becomes twisted somehow. So evil is good that becomes twisted somehow. Like, for your Tolkien reference, the orcs are actually elves that were tortured and twisted into bad guys. Like, evil can never make anything in and of itself. So I say that, and if you ever read the Purgatorio by Dante, everybody reads the Inferno, right? I mean, it's a great book, but the best of the trilogy is the Purgatorio. But in the Purgatorio, you learn that each level of purgatory is something has gone wrong with love. And so what I want to make the case here is the wrongness that the Israelites are having is deficient love. In other words, their love for God is not enough. And I think that's probably, unfortunately, a song that we can find ourselves singing far too often. And it's hard because it sounds like, yeah, that's kind of a big deal, but actually it is a really big deal. Take a quick look at verse 20. So it's not part of our regular reading. So the Israelites are going to complain again about not having anything but manna to eat, and the Lord's going to send them quail. But I want you to see how the Lord speaks about it in verse 20, because this is what I think is at the heart of complaints. This is why complaining is such a big deal. So verse 20, God says he's going to give them quail for so long, for a whole month, till it comes out of your nose and makes you nauseated because, and here's what I think complaint is, you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? In other words, complaint is so bad because it's a rejection of God and God's sovereignty and God's love and God's wisdom, because God has you exactly in the place where he wants you, including the negative things that are part of it. And that's treachery. That's a really big deal. It's interesting. You have rejected the Lord who is among you. Like, God is right there with you, and you still complain about it. Yeah, I think you could probably make that case. So here's another way to think of, I'm sorry. Touche. Here's another way to say the same thing, and maybe this will click because this is a little more catchy, if you will, than, you know, Augustine and Dante on the nature of evil. But if you think about it, complaining is the opposite of thy will be done. Complaining is the opposite of thy will be done. Complaining is basically saying to God, again, I'm going to use a strong word, okay? I'm not going to cuss, but strong word. But complaining is basically saying to God, thy will sucks. If you prefer the King James, thy will sucketh. But like, really, that's, if you think about it, that's what complaining is. It's saying to God, your will sucks. Like, you know, this, and that's treachery. That's rebellion. That's poison. That's terrible stuff. That's deficient love. So how do you overcome that? And I'm going to try to bring it back to your God is too small. Your God is too small. You don't realize how loving he is. You don't realize how he took you out of Egypt. You don't realize that he's the God who tore a hole in the universe to bring you home. For some reason, I'm still thinking about the Deadpool thing from a couple days ago. I almost thought, and it's totally cool, I almost thought Nathan was going to make for the art on that one. I'm going to call it Dead Porg, you know, because I like Porg. So like a Porg with the black eyes for, anyway, okay. So, but like, think about the God who tore the universe. I think his art is fantastic. I don't know how he makes it, but I love seeing that cover art. Anyway, but like the God who tore a hole in the universe to get you, the God who died on the cross and suffered the horrific things that he suffered for you, he's not going to leave you hanging. I mean, the whole reason he was left hanging so that you would not be. And that's what we got to remember. That's how we got to keep our love from being deficient. We got to remember our big God when we are tempted to complain and gripe about things. And then one more side comment. It's not the main point, but, you know, this is whatever, a little pepper strip or something like that next to the cheese ball. I keep wanting to call it a cheese egg, but next to the cheese ball. Look at verse 3, look at verse 2. The people cried out, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. And that's just to remember the remarkable power of intercession and prayer. And for real, the thing that Gina sends out and just the things we know about each other, pray for one another. One of my favorite analogies for prayer is, you know, the guys who, when Jesus heals the guy on the mat and his friends carry him and they tear down the roof to get the guy on the mat down to Jesus. Like, that guy couldn't get to Jesus, so they carried him to Jesus. And how many times in our lives do we need somebody to carry us to Jesus because we're just not in a place where we come to Jesus? So in that sense, in our prayer lives, let's be mat carriers. Let's carry people to Jesus, you know, whatever their state is. Again, that's not the main point. That was just a side thing for what it's worth. So, big idea so far. Complaint is when you have the wrong treasure. I'm sorry, I didn't even explain the treasure thing. So one of the questions I almost did for the opening question today, but just decided not to, is if the Matrix were real, would you choose to stay in or get out? And it's probably old enough that half of you don't even like, what's the Matrix? Like, you know, which pill would you take, if you will? But I say that because, you know, would you take reality as miserable as it is? Or would you rather stay in the fake computer program that's pleasant and fake, but is pleasant? You know what I mean? But I say that because the Israelites are like, put me back in, you know, plug me back in, take me back to Egypt. They're rejecting God because their real treasure is not God, it's their own comfort. And so the question is, what's our real treasure? And if your treasure is not Jesus himself, then that's deficient love, and that's obviously a big problem. And that's really, if you think about it, I know this is hard, okay? This is tough to think about, but that's what's at the heart of complaint. At the heart of complaint is a too small God who either doesn't love me or doesn't plan well. And I don't treasure you, Jesus, because you're putting me in this miserable thing. Well, you got to trust him, as corny as it sounds. All right. That was first three verses. Any other thoughts, comments, responses on complaint or those first three verses?
Framed it really good. And we talked some last week about what is God doing in Numbers. Or that's teaching you drive this stake in the ground. Action's harsh. You're complaining in the harsh moment. For them and for us, as we read. When I put that context, it makes so much sense why this reaction is.
Yep. Yep.
I am first.
It's not only about the complaint, it's versus who you're complaining to.
Oh, I'm going to say that later, so you're stealing my thunder. No, for real. No, say it.
I mean, in the beginning, it talks about the people complaining and the Lord heard it. They weren't complaining to him. And then also, like, they cried out to Moses. They didn't cry out to the Lord, who was clearly doing the fire, and it took Moses asking the Lord. So, like, to me, it's like we're going to complain. It's in our nature, but we need to take our complaints to the Lord. For anything about it.
She's exactly right, and yeah. I hope somehow that got on the mic, but I'll make this point more, but I'll probably run out of time anyway, but Moses will complain in verses 10 to 15, and I will, like, I wrestled with this, of course. Victoria and her brilliance figures it out in 30 seconds. I wrestled with it for whatever, 2 days. I'm like, why didn't Moses get struck down? You know, how come Moses didn't get struck down? And my answer, I think she's right. My answer is, he didn't complain about God. He complained to God. I think that's the difference, because she's right. It's all, did you notice it in, by the way, if you care, quick side note, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 10, so easy to remember, 1C1010, at least if you have that kind of a memory. But 1 Corinthians 10:10. Paul explicitly points out how the Israelites complained and were put to death. So complaining is a big deal. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 10, let us not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroyer. So complaining is a really big deal. But anyway, now I'm trying to remember where in the world was I going with that. Oh, did you notice it in verse 1? People became like those who complain of adversity in the ears of the Lord, and the Lord heard them. It's almost like God overheard them griping. You know what I mean? It's almost like when you're griping at the water cooler and suddenly the next thing you know, the boss is behind you and you've missed all the cues from everybody telling you to be quiet, or you accidentally hit reply all instead of reply, and you know, you were griping to your buddy about, you know, and suddenly you realize, oh, he got that, you know, or she got that, whoever your boss is. Anyway, so, but I think Victoria's exactly right. I think the Israelites are complaining about God instead of to God. I mean, think about the book of Job. Job says some horrible things about God in the course of his complaints. horrible things. And when you get to the end, God says to the three friends, you have not spoken of me well as Job has. But where did Job go with his complaints? Where was his treasure? And his God was big enough to handle his complaints. Now look, we still need to not complain. But what I am saying is, like, I think Victoria's right. There is something to taking your complaints to God instead of anywhere else. Think of it as the ultimate Saving Private Ryan thing. For those of you guys who like Saving Private Ryan, there's a scene where Tom Hanks is explaining that commands always have to go up the chain, never across and never down. Complaints always have to go up the chain. So, and if you need an excuse to watch Saving Private Ryan, there you go. I'm sorry?
Pastor Matt. God welcomes questions. Why is this happening? Help me understand. Questions are very different. Help me understand is a very different point of view than this. Wah, wah, wah. This is hard. I don't like it.
Yeah. Yep. Right? And I think we'll see more of that, Lord willing, if and when we get to the third section. Good comments. Anything else? Okay, so let's go to the next section. We're going to see more complaints, except this time the text is going to get specific about what the complaint was. So I'm going to argue that this thing is about wrong desire, and this is going to be about excessive love. More on that in a moment. But if somebody be kind enough to start reading in verse 4 and go through verse 9, please.
Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. Remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the barley. Our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all that this manna. Now the manna was like coriander seed, that's like that of yellow. The people went about and gathered it and ground it in handfuls or beat it in the corners. Pots and make cakes of it. The taste of it was like the taste of cake made with oil. Dew fell upon the camp in the night, and the manna fell with it.
Bravo. Thank you kindly. So, simple, stupid question, at least it's meant to be. What's the Israelites' complaint now specifically about?
They're missing Egypt.
Correct. We've only got this supernaturally appearing food that, you know, we can make into all these different things, and we'd rather be, you know, again, Matrix reference, plug us back in. Send us, I think, for you guys who've seen The Matrix, it makes me think of that conversation where Cypher is eating steak while he's talking to the agent, and he's talking about how good the steak is. Like, that's kind of what the Israelites are doing right here. Like, send us back. And again, the argument I'm going to make here is this is excessive love. So the first argument was it was insufficient love for God. This is excessive love for God's gifts, like to the point where it drowns out God. I remember one of my senior quotes, apparently today is lots of movie references today, not that that's unusual ever, but one of my senior quotes was from Lonesome Dove, which every human being should see if he or she hasn't, but at one point Gus McRae says, if you want any one thing in life too much, it's more than likely to turn out to be a disappointment. The only healthy way to live, as I see it, is to learn to enjoy all the little everyday things, like a soft bed or a glass of buttermilk, or a feisty gentleman like myself, he finishes off with. But I remember thinking that, and even before I became a Christian, like, of course I agreed with that, but then it was like, but can't you ever want something a lot? Like, that's kind of the Buddhist answer, by the way. If you know Buddhism, Buddhism says all suffering is caused by desire, so the solution is get rid of desire, and that'll get rid of suffering. Now, I think Christianity would agree with Buddha on the problem, so to speak, but has a better solution, and that is change the object of your desire. So instead of it being the wrong desire, make your desire God himself. Okay, so you don't have cucumbers. So you don't have, let's change the thing. So you don't have the relationship you want. So you don't have the child you want. So you don't have the job you want. So you don't have the health you want. So you don't have whatever. Is Jesus going to be enough? Is having Jesus, is having the God with you, the God who walks with you in this wilderness. What would you rather have? God in the wilderness or everything else in a paradise but not God? Which is actually a hard question if you think about it. Of course, we know what the answer should be, but like if you really think about it, that's a tough and a very worthwhile question. But if your God is not too small, I mean, by the way, this is why the Lord's, not exclusively why, but this is part of why the Lord's Prayer is for our daily bread. It is a looking back to the manna in the wilderness, which was given to us daily. This is why Jesus is the bread of life. He is sufficient. Okay, maybe some days he's not. I don't remember what's in the list. Cucumbers and garlic and what a terrible list. Anyway, but maybe he's not. Sorry if you like those kinds of things, but you know. He's not these things, but he's enough, and may he be enough. So anyway, I'm gonna try to scurry a little more just looking at the time, but I think the Israelites' problem here is their wrong desire. They want the pleasant things of Egypt. And by the way, isn't it amazing how much they forget, oh yeah, we got that because we were slaves, if you know they even really did get those things. But how much better it is to have Jesus himself. Further observations or comments on verses 4 through 9. So to finish things out, we're going to take a twist. And so we looked at wrong treasure, not loving God enough. Wrong desire, loving other things too much. Now I want to look at wrong responsibility. And this is the third example of love that Augustine and Dante and Tolkien would talk about, and that is misdirected love. It's when you have a good thing, but in too high of a proportion, because responsibility is a good thing, but I'm going to make the case that Moses assumes way too much of it because his God is too small. So, let's actually look at the text, and then I'll try to throw a lesson or two out. So if somebody would read verses 10 through 15, please.
Also very active. Why are you treating me? Mercy on me. I give birth to them. Did I bring them? Why did you tell me to carry them on my arm? I put my hand. Whining for me to say.
Hunky-dory, isn't that a great way to end the text? Not looking for anything in particular, but any reactions emotionally to this section? At least for me, it can be easy to get down on Moses, like, come on, man, get over it. But for what it's worth, like, remember, like, literally, this guy's got a million people, like, literally a million people riding his back. If you do the numbers, he's got approximately a million people. And they're all, back to Victoria's point, they're not going to the Lord. They're all standing in their doorways, crying and weeping and complaining, you know. And Moses does what is a good thing to do, and that is to assume responsibility to solve their problem, but he does it too much. Am I supposed to carry these people? Did I give birth to them? Am I supposed to find meat for all these people? Am I the one who has to take them to the promised land? And again, I don't know, maybe this is, again, me and my therapy sessions, but like, this is really relatable. It's funny, like, it's just, again, my best friend at school is Matthew Hendricks, and he and I have this thing, we call it the that guy syndrome. I don't know, okay, more movie references. If you've ever seen Air Force One, there's this part in Air Force One where he's taken over the plane, and there's this terrorist is making all these demands, and he's talking to the vice president, played by Glenn Close, does a great job, and he's like, and that's what I want, so make it happen. And like, she's seated at the table with the whole cabinet, and everybody at the cabinet turns and looks at her, and the camera's like her looking at everybody looking at you. It's like, that's my life in a moment. Like, you're that guy. It was just funny. We had a team of four that we were supposed to put together this professional development thing, and nobody said anybody who was in charge. And the four of us got together, and I was on it. And they all looked at me and like, so what are we going to do? I'm like, who put me in charge? But anyway, so the all that to say, like, at least for me, this is very relatable. But both for me and for Moses, the thing to remember is your God is too small. Your God can handle this. Yes, assume responsibility as an act of love, but if you're assuming it too much, it's on you. I mean, this is the hero's downfall, right? Like, this is what villains do to bad guys or to good guys. They make them feel responsible. If you remember in Dark Knight, the Joker says he's going to kill everybody unless Batman reveals himself, and then Batman's about to turn himself in, and there's this great line where Christian Bale says, well, his girlfriend says, do you really think the Joker's going to stop? And Christian Bale says, I have enough blood on my hands. And it's like, no, you don't. You're not the one killing people, but he assumes the responsibility. Anyway, my point in all this is to say, it is a good thing to assume responsibility, but too much. It is a good thing to want to raise good kids, but what if it becomes too much? It is a good thing to want to be in shape, but what if it becomes too much? It is a good thing to want to care for people, but what if it becomes too much? And how do you know it gets too much? One, you're getting all resentful and angry like this, but two, you're forgetting how big your God is who can handle people's problems. So yes, absolutely, do your part, but trust the Lord to meet people's needs. Let's see. This is the Jesus who bears our burdens. Because think about it, and here I'm coming in for a landing, and if you got to go, that's fine too. But for take everything Moses says, and who really could have said that and meant it? Who really could have said, why have I not found favor in your sight that you put the burden of all these people on me? Who really could have said, did I give birth to them that you should say to me, carry them in your arms as a nurse carries a nursing infant to the land which you swore to your fathers? If you're going to deal with me this way, please kill me now. And I mean, I think you can probably figure it out. Like, you can put those words on Jesus' lips, except like in a good way, like in a real way. And so I say all that because how do we get over this? We realize that Jesus already assumed this burden. Jesus already has got this professional development plan. I don't know what it is. Now, it is my job to be responsible and care for it and do the best job I can with it. But when push comes to shove, he's the one who's going to make it happen, not me. And of course, that's a very small example. There's 100 other examples. Jesus is going to take care of my kids. Jesus is going to take care of my health. Jesus is going to take care of my neighbor. Yes, I need to love them. Yes, I need to be good and responsible. But Martin, here, I'll make a church history reference instead of a movie reference. Martin Luther once said to Philip Melanchthon, let Philip cease to rule the world. Because Philip Melanchthon was a worrier. He was always worried about things happening. And Martin said to him, let Philip cease to rule the world. So let us cease to rule the world, because that's not your job. God's already got that. So that's it. I'm done. Big idea to exercise contentment instead of complaint, because we sort of realize how big our God is. So very abrupt ending, but we need to get out of here, and you got kids to take care of and stuff like that, people to love. Any parting comments, questions, thoughts? Good. Joseph, you don't have to. Will you press out? Sorry, you guys with same names can't sit together. I did it with poor Nathan last week or 2 weeks ago. I was thinking of this Joseph closer to us, but whoever speaks up first, I guess.
Which one?
I can't remember your last name, man. I'm sorry. Not Baroa. Joseph. Okay, thank you, sir. My apologies for the very awkward ending.
You're looking for Zach's message today.
Great prayer.
Thank you.
Take care, beloved. Yes, ma'am.